Hey, this is Scott Ardella, author of The Edge of Strength, now available on Amazon, and you're listening to the Ardella Training Podcast, the strength and performance podcast for the serious fitness enthusiast. Now, let's get started with this week's show. Hey guys, if you're a coach or trainer, or just a serious fitness enthusiast who's committed to always learning and developing yourself, then you have to check out On Target Publications, where you'll find many great educational products and resources related to human movement and optimizing physical performance. This is where I go to build my own training and performance library to stay on the cutting edge. Go to ardellatraining.com/learn to see all the great educational resources that are available to take your knowledge and training to that next level. That's ardellatraining.com/learn. All right, guys, what's up? Welcome to episode number 174 this week. My guest is Charlie the Spaniard Brenneman, and I love providing different interviews to you guys. This is a great session with professional MMA fighter Charlie Brenneman, and we talk a lot about his journey from classroom to cage and a lot of the great things that he's learned along the way. And this was a really fun, really informative interview. I know that you'll definitely love it. So I'll tell you more about that in just a minute. A couple of quick updates, and then we're going to get right into the interview session. So I do want to remind you that there are new things going on with the podcast. One of the new things is the interrogation series. These are real world chat sessions, and they've been amazing so far. So far, we've had three interviews that have gone live. I have three more interviews to share with you. And these are really high-power, short interview sessions, very unique, and every single one is so different. If you haven't heard the interrogation series with people from the Ardella Training community, I definitely encourage you to go back and check those out. Again, they're short, sweet, and to the point, and each one has a great lesson. So far, the interviews have been with Kat, Jim, and Justin. Thank you so much, guys, for sharing your great insights, and I'm looking forward to sharing the next installments of the interrogation series coming soon. Now, I also wanted to let you know that it's been a while since I've done a solo show. I've had so many great interviews. It's really been amazing, and I'm so honored and excited to have so many great guests here on the Ardella Training Podcast. But I am going to be getting back to solo shows very soon, and we're going to do these short episodes where I'll pretty much be focusing on a specific topic or answering your questions or even sharing great resources and reviewing things that I use with you. So stay tuned for that. I just wanted to let you know that I'm not getting away from the solo shows, the solo episodes, but it's just been so crazy with all of the great interviews. I've had a ton of great interviews, but we are going to get back to these solo episodes very soon. So just an update with that. And of course, guys, as always, if you like the Ardella Training Podcast, please be sure to take a minute and drop in a quick review in iTunes. It's so incredibly easy to do, and it really helps this podcast be found in iTunes. So if you could, take a minute and drop in your short review in iTunes. So this week's interview, again, is with Charlie Brenneman. Charlie the Spaniard Brenneman is a professional MMA fighter. After teaching Spanish for 3 years and winning Spike TV's Pros vs. Joes, Charlie decided to leave his job to pursue a master's degree and also begin his professional fighting career. And that's when the Spaniard was born. In 2011, he was ranked as high as number 7 in the world, and the Spaniard has fought at the highest level of the sport in 3 countries. Now, I'll tell you this. Charlie Brenneman is a great guy. I really enjoyed this chat, and it was amazing how this interview came to be, actually. And I'm so glad that Charlie came on the show and shared his great story and wisdom and journey with us here on the show. You're going to hear about his epiphany moment and why he decided to become a fighter in the first place. You're going to hear about some of the biggest challenges that he had to face as a fighter, and you're going to hear his explanation of the difference between talent and skill. This is really great stuff. And of course, we talk about training as well. So lots of great insight in this interview session. I think you'll love it. So let's do it. Let's jump into this week's interview with Charlie the Spaniard Brenneman. Enjoy it, guys. All right. Well, I am very excited to have Charlie the Spaniard Brenneman join the podcast this week. Charlie is a professional MMA fighter, speaker, author, mentor, and so much more. So, Charlie, thank you so much for being here. I'm really looking forward to this chat.
My pleasure, man. Let's get into it.
Absolutely. So for those that don't know you, can you tell the audience here a little bit about yourself? And I know that we're definitely going to dive deeper into your story during the interview, but let's hear the big picture of who is Charlie Brenneman.
So the condensed version, I guess the very condensed version is he's a wrestler. That's where it all started, and that's what has caused me or led me to where I'm at today. But you know, the Cliff's Notes version, I grew up a wrestler in Central Pennsylvania, went on to college. Always academics and athletics were at the forefront of everything I did. I graduated from Lock Haven, went back home to my hometown, Hollidaysburg, Pennsylvania, and I was a Spanish teacher and wrestling coach, and I thought that's exactly where I wanted to be for the rest of my life. I was of the mindset that I'm done with all the sacrifice of a life of wrestling. You know, it was very trying, a lot of sacrifice, a lot of heartbreaks, and I just thought I'm done. And then when I got into the normal world, I realized I don't want to be in the normal world. So I thought, what am I going to do? And around that time, mixed martial arts, you know, it was already kind of gaining a little bit of popularity, the UFC especially. And I saw a friend of mine from college wrestling get signed to the UFC, and like kind of an epiphany moment, I thought, you know what, I want to fight in the UFC. And that changed the trajectory of my life. And I mean, at that point in time, I was the furthest thing from a fighter. Like, I couldn't have been a more opposite thing than a fighter. But I kind of looked at my attributes and thought, okay, I'm good at wrestling, grappling, grabbing people, throwing them down, controlling them. I'm going to give it a shot. And for about the last 10 years, that's what I've been doing, fighting professionally, much of that time in the UFC. And present day, I'm transitioning into a professional speaking career.
You know, that was one of my questions I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned the epiphany moment, and I've gotten into your book. I've read about maybe 25% of the book so far. I'm reading so many books right now. I've had so many authors on the show. It's been crazy, but I love the book so far, and your book is Driven, which we will talk about. But talk about that epiphany moment. What was it that made you just say, hey, I want to do this?
You know, I get asked a lot, you know, honestly, from kids to, you know, very successful professionals that, you know, what's the secret, or what do you do, or, you know, how can I succeed or accomplish my dreams and goals? And honestly, it just comes down, I think I have a mindset that, you know, I have a vision for myself and a vision for my life that it's like there's no mistake, there's no second guessing, there's no mistaking. It's like, I mean, I have a dream of relocating to Spain for a large portion of the year. I'm living my life to make it happen. So that day when I saw Frankie Edgar signed to the UFC, I assessed my skills and my qualities. It was like, boom, I'm going to do it, because that was the next thing I could do. I couldn't wrestle anymore. I still wanted to compete. I wanted to have freedom, and that was it. And then once I had that epiphany, it was action. So from that day forward, I took the actions necessary to make it happen. And that was really what made that epiphany like a real live thing.
So I think what you're saying is maybe just having the moment where you had a clear decision on what you wanted to do.
Yeah. You know what? I call it an authentic declaration. Okay. So it was like, I just, nobody was listening except me, but I just decided, I said it. I told my best friend, and it was like, once I told my best friend, it was kind of fact.
Okay. So let me ask you about the Spaniard. How did that develop? How did the name develop? And what is the story behind Charlie the Spaniard Brenneman?
So I'm not Spanish. That's met with surprise oftentimes, but I was a Spanish teacher, as I had, I believe I had said, but when I was in college, we would do wrestling camps, and my wrestling coach, his name is Rocky Bonomo, and he has a twin brother, and they are the two funniest guys that I've ever met in my life, and they would just play off of each other. Honestly, an hour would pass by, and you'd be laughing the whole time, and you would think, wait a minute, did we just learn anything? No, we didn't. We've just been laughing for an hour, but they would give us all nicknames, and at first, he started calling me Antonio Banderas because I had really long, curly hair,
right,
the Spanish actor. And then eventually that morphed into the Spaniard because it's a little bit more tougher sounding. And then when I started fighting, it was like, that's the only nickname I've ever had. And coupled with the fact that Gladiator's name is Spaniard in the movie Gladiator, you know, it just kind of fit well.
Nice, nice. It's a name that stuck, obviously. Mm-hmm. It started to develop and it stuck with you. So,
and it's something that I didn't even realize back then, but in terms of like creating my own business and program, et cetera, you know, it's a brand. I didn't know it at the time, but it's something that sticks in people's minds.
That's funny the way that develops. I mean, it really is. Talk about your journey. So again, going from classroom to cage, talk about it. Talk about the whole evolution of becoming a UFC fighter.
Yeah. When I left my teaching job, you know, I come from a very conservative background. I'm very structured and organized, and I make sure, you know, I have all my bases covered financially, every area you can think of that you could possibly worry about, I think about. And it was a total, I mean, it was a shock to my system. It was a change in everything I had ever done, everything I had ever believed or thought possible. And I left my job. I gave everything up, my salary, my health insurance, everything. And I drove into a world that I had nothing about. So it was intimidating. It was like daunting. It was scary. It was exciting. You know, all of that was going on. But more than anything, I had to learn. I had to learn how to become a fighter because I was not born a fighter at all. So it was like all of that stuff that was going on in my mind, all this thinking and thoughts and anxieties, et cetera, they were kind of squashed because I had to spend my time learning. And that's exactly what I did, was hop right into learning.
So I have kind of a follow-up question I'll ask you a little bit down the line. But talk about some of the biggest challenges that you faced developing yourself as a fighter. You talked about giving up everything. But what are the biggest challenges you faced as a fighter?
You know, for me, on a personal level, I'm very, very family-oriented. I come from a small town with a very close family. And for me, leaving that comfort zone was very hard. I had traveled internationally in college, and I'm very comfortable with it. But I mean, uprooting was extremely difficult. But I knew that to get to the level that I wanted to get to, I had to be around the best. And they were a few hours away in New York and New Jersey. Challenge-wise, it was assimilating into this culture of fighters. I mean, I had watched these guys on TV literally a year before and thought, wow, these guys are scary. These, you know, and I looked at them as superheroes. And now I was training with them and beating some of them. So that self-belief and that self-talk and that realization of, you know, who I now was extremely interesting and weird, for lack of a better word, to get used to.
Yeah,
one more thing that was in it is still a challenge for me is travel. Because I'm so family oriented, I've never completely left home. I mean, I have physically, but I'm always traveling back home. When I prior to getting married, I was always traveling back to Pennsylvania to be with my fiance, and that's always been an obstacle, is the amount of travel that I've endured as well.
So it sounds like kind of what you're saying is the getting out of your comfort zone was a big thing.
Where you
push yourself to get out of the comfort zone.
Very, very much so. And that's kind of how I've lived my life, to be honest. And I mean, take it right down to the culmination of fighting inside the UFC octagon. I mean, when that door shut and they say, Charlie Spanier Brennerman, and then they announce the other guy, and then they say, fight. I mean, up to that split second, I'm out of my comfort zone. I mean, I'm totally in my mind thinking, what in the heck is going on here? How did I get here? And then it's like, fight, and you have no choice but to fight. It's odd, but I live for those situations, to put myself in those comfort zones, because you got to fight or flight, and it's a test that I enjoy.
Talk a little bit more about that. Talk about maybe that 5 minutes before the fight, before you even go into the ring, and then like you just said, when the fight starts, what's the change that happens in an instant?
You know, it's very odd. So if you've ever seen Southpaw with Jake Gyllenhaal, I think they do a really good job of portraying what it's like inside the locker room. And getting on site, you know, walking to your locker room, getting changed, getting your hands wrapped, getting the gloves taped on your hands, it's very surreal. And it's honestly, it's very similar to a funeral. You know, nobody really knows what to say. You try to say things that make you laugh and make you feel good.
Right.
But there's always this impending sense of, you know, not death, but doom or gloom or darkness, because it's just a totally relatively uncontrolled situation. It's very lonely and very, I don't want to say dreary, but it's very, very lonely.
So you kind of have these polar opposites, I guess.
Yep. Yes, very much so. And oddly enough, it's when you get out there, you know, there's so much like pandemonium, noise, ruckus going on. But inside, I know for me personally, I'm very, very calm. You know, aside from that, like, it's just lonely, man. That's it. It's lonely. It's a calming, lonely feeling.
Do you think the pre-fight anxiety that any human experiences, I mean, I imagine that you were able to channel it where it worked very well for you once the fight started.
Very much so. And that comes with a level of confidence, honestly, that I never truly had in wrestling. I was very good in wrestling. I was a state runner-up 2 times in high school. I finished the round of 12, 1 match from All-American in college. So I was very good, but I never fully had, like, I never had it. I never had that mental confidence that I needed. So having that by my side in fighting, it was the answer to everything competitive that I had ever wanted.
What are the big reasons you think you were successful as a fighter? If you had to name the top reasons that made you successful in the ring, what were they?
One would be my preparation. I think I trained, honestly, I know one person that trains harder than I do, and that's Frankie Edgar, who was a UFC champion. Other than that, I truly, truly believe that it was my preparation and the professionalism that I took the job with. You know, I looked at myself as a professional, so I lived my life as a professional. It's humbling to hear, you know, some of the testimonials that I got from my book. It's humbling to hear my trainers say that about me. And up until I read that from them, I never really thought of that. That's something that definitely helped me. Another thing is just my natural wrestling scrambling ability. You know, different athletes from different martial arts translate differently into mixed martial arts. You know, you could have a great boxer who doesn't have great, you know, attributes in other sports. But with me, it was my ability to scramble. And I think technically that was my best asset.
Talk about the preparation. I think that's really that's so important. So let's drill down to that a little bit more. And specifically, what did you do to prepare that maybe separated you from others?
I wouldn't necessarily say the amount, you know, because a lot of, I hear people say they train for 8 hours a day. I never trained for 8 hours a day. but just looking at it with the overall mindset of consuming every bit of information from experts as possible. I went in with a very open mind. I'm not afraid to ask questions. I ask questions. I'm obsessive. And I think a lot of people, that's what leads or aids in their success. But in terms of preparation, it's, you know, we have to cover everything. We have to cover wrestling, boxing, kickboxing, jiu-jitsu. I mean, you name it, we have to train it. So it's very regimented. It's very organized. Looking back on my career, I was very overtrained. My nutrition was way off.
Really?
I certainly pushed my body way too hard without giving it the proper amount of rest time. So, you know, those are all things that I'm realizing now that I'll just help to convey to the next generation, whether they're fighters or wrestlers or basketball players or whatever. You know, I kind of take that from my experience.
So if you had to do it all over again, what would you do differently? It sounds like recovery, nutrition would be things that you would approach differently.
Yeah, 100% recovery and nutrition. Honestly, those are probably it, to be honest.
Okay.
You know, I'm on a very regimented schedule now. I'm very organized. But in looking back on my career, I thought I was then, but I definitely wasn't. Because when I was fighting, it was all fighting and nothing else. You know, it was
right.
I hardly ever read. You know, I watched, you know, Netflix a lot. And now okay. I'm thinking, man, I could have been like growing as a person, which would have then helped me grow as a fighter as well.
But do you think if you're watching Netflix a lot, I mean, was it more because of the you needed the mental relaxation after all of the physical training? Or
for a small amount of time, yes. I mean, most of my training was early in the morning and then noontime. So then you're done at, you know, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock maybe. So then, yeah, you can have an hour or two of Netflix, but then you're kind of rest and recovered. I wish I would have been more into developing myself.
Right, right. Well, we always look back and learn from those experiences for sure. Talk about your approach to training. And let me ask you this, since this is a, you know, strength and performance podcast, we talk a lot about strength, movement, performance. How important is strength for you as a fighter?
It's huge. I mean, in strength, by the technical definition of strength, I'm going to go on just strength as to what the general person thinks of it.
Yes.
For me, what helped me most, and you know, you hear a lot about core training or body awareness or good hips, you know, these kind of non-tangibles. For me, that was my biggest asset: muscular endurance.
Yes.
And then the body awareness. And what does body awareness mean? It means, I mean, for lack of a better way of explaining, it means putting your arm or your head or your leg where it's supposed to be at the right time. And from a lifetime of wrestling, I had that ability to kind of sense, okay, choke is coming in, or don't put my head here. So wrestling helped me an extreme amount. The muscular endurance, so the high intensity training for me was huge. I did a lot of circuits, a lot of 30-second blasts, 15-second rests, 45-second blasts, 20-second rests. So it was a lot of metabolic up and down, up and down. Because trust me, the last thing you want is to be dead tired in the octagon in front of 15,000
people. Sure. Yeah, no question. Conditioning is a huge, very critical component to your sport and the muscular endurance component. For strength, and I know this will depend on where you are in terms of getting ready for the fight, so things are going to change as you move closer to the fight, but what would you do for strength? What were some of maybe like your top training tools? Kettlebells, body weight training, sandbags? Yep. How did you approach that as far as?
Yeah, that's exactly where I was headed with it. So I would generally do, so let's say I fight today. So then I'll take a week or 10 days relatively off, and then I'll get back into it. The first couple weeks of strength training after my fight were generally traditional lifting. I never really got into heavy deadlifts or heavy squats, heavy cleans, but I would do them. I growing up, I never did them. So, you know, it wasn't normally my thing, but, you know, traditional lifting, weightlifting, 10, 8, 6 reps, that for a couple of weeks. And then I would get more into kettlebells, bags, sledgehammers, stuff like that. And then slowly morph it into circuit training. So the last 3 or 4 weeks prior to a fight, we're basically doing circuits to mimic that of a 3 by 5 minute round fight.
Sure, sure. Makes total sense, of course. And the training is multifaceted.
Yeah. And it's another thing is I linked up with a great strength and conditioning coach who has since passed away. And I write about that in my book. But I mean, he opened my eyes up to everything, to footwork, you know, to ladders, to agility, to all kinds of things that I had never been exposed to. And it got to the point where it was like, you know, training was awesome because I never knew what we were going to do. But at the end of the day, it all revolved around, for me, muscular endurance, because I needed to always be able to keep my hands up and keep moving.
What do you think your greatest gift is as a fighter?
Hard work. And that, I don't know how that sounds, if it's generic, if it's cliche, what, but look, I'm not a fighter. I've had 27 fights, 11 in the UFC. I made myself a fighter. So, and I made myself a fighter by being focused and busting my butt, because I certainly, my natural instincts are not to fight. My natural instincts are to wrestle. And then I had to transition that into fighting.
I saw that in doing some of the research for the interview, you talk about a difference between talent and skill. So talk about that. What is the difference between talent and skill?
Yeah, I was a talented wrestler from the get-go. You know, I was 8 years old. I got pinned my first wrestling match ever, but I came back the next year and it essentially never stopped. I won the vast majority of my matches, so I was naturally talented. But in terms of skill, if you take that, I mean, not only into wrestling, but especially into fighting. I mean, my talent as a wrestler equaled nothing in fighting. I had to learn the skills of becoming a professional fighter. I wrote a blog the other day. So we all, not we all, but a lot of driven people have a vision of who they want to be or who they want to become. But wanting and hoping and dreaming, it does not equate to that. You have to obtain the skills of that person. So while you may be talented at many things, to become something that you're not, you have to learn, like, mechanically how to do it. So for me, it was that's what I'm talking about, all that hard work and dedication is acquiring the skills, the actual nuts and bolts of becoming a fighter. Hands up, you know, not standing square, keeping your chin down, following through on your shots, those types of things.
Is one more important than the other?
You know, that's a great question. So let me think about that for about 2 seconds before I just start talking. I honestly think that I'm going to say skill is more important, because you have tons and tons of athletes who are talented but don't put the work into developing the skills to produce. And, you know, how many stories are there of those people who never live up to their talent? So certainly I would put that on skill.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think it's, you know, skill is something that needs to be continued to develop. So if you're very talented, if you're gifted and with your talent and you're not developing your skill, it's going to be a real detriment. And that goes with anything in life.
Yeah, I was going to say that carries over. You took the words out of my mouth. That carries over into life. I mean, it's a continual evolutionary process. And then one day we stop breathing. That's how I look at our lives, to be honest.
Right. So looking at this skill talk, do you feel like you can continue to develop forever, really, where we can continue to develop ourselves?
I do, because there's so many areas of our lives and there's so many. So for me personally, you know, I started as a wrestler, I continued as a wrestler, and then I was a teacher, and then I had a stint on reality television, which catapulted my fighting career. And now as my fighting career is winding down, embarking on a professional speaking career. So there's always areas to develop your skills. And also in that time, a recent husband, a recent father,
right,
a homeowner. I mean, there's just if it's like if you want to get the most out of life, there's a million, more than a million things to develop your skills in so that on that last breath, you're the best version of Scott that you can be, and I'm the best Spaniard that I can be.
Absolutely. Totally agree with you there, man. So what was the big thing if you look back at your career as a fighter and the things that you just mentioned, being a father, a husband, a speaker, all the things that you're transitioning in your life now? What was the one thing that you took away from being a fighter that you apply to every other area of your life?
You know, my professional fighting career, so at one point in time, I was ranked number 7 in the world. And, you know, before that and certainly after that, I was essentially in the eyes of the, quote, MMA fans, not worth a dime, right? So I lived a real Rocky story, like real. I couldn't have planned it any better. Right. And at the same time, I've been the recipient of the most ruthless, like non-provoked hatred that exists out there. So, and I'm not the only one. I mean, I suppose anyone in the public eye receives it. But for me, coming out of fighting and being the highs and the lows and the support and the hatred, it really taught me that I need to be okay with me. And if I'm okay with me and I'm living my values, then, you know, you hate me, I'm sorry. I can't do anything about it. But I've gotten to a point where I waste very little time worrying about the opinions of others.
Well, values are really critical in, I guess, being the person that we are, obviously, in driving our life, right? So it's so important to understand our values and live by those values, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And I do a lot of work with a lot of people in general, but especially young people. And I talk about, I won't even say especially young people, because it's, I mean, in the professional world, in high school, you know, it's, if I'm living by my values, if I'm living by my compass, right, my moral compass, then every decision I make is okay, because it's for the right reason and it's according to my values. So it's almost like it makes your decision making by default, and it takes the burden off of you.
I hope you don't mind me asking this question, but you kind of piqued my interest to ask this. You talked about kind of the dark side there, that the hatred that you experienced. What was that all about?
You know, I see the world from my perspective, and every once in a while I have to check myself and realize, okay, you know, there's other people in my boat, et cetera. If you go to the social media pages of any famous person, you pick the most beautiful woman in the world.
Right.
You go to her page and someone's telling her that she's the ugliest, nastiest woman on the face of the planet. So it's unnecessary, it's unprovoked, and it's everywhere. For me personally, you know, when I've gotten knocked out on TV before, and imagine training your butt off, going into an octagon in front of a million people, getting knocked out, getting home, and then getting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of messages telling you how you are terrible and you're the worst thing in the world and you're not worthy of your wife and you're not worthy of being a professional fighter. And it's like those low times are when you ask what I took away from the sport. Those low times, It's like what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I hate to use cliches, it's a reason. There's a reason there are cliches.
Absolutely.
But it developed in me a confidence that it's like, all right, man. Yeah, you're great, man. You hate me. Cool. And then just go. Yeah. I'm going on. You go on. It is what it is.
Yeah. I do not understand that at all. I really don't. I mean, I don't understand the energy of why people would do that, you know, to take the energy to write a negative tweet or an email, or, I mean, just don't say anything at all if you actually feel that way towards someone. So that the whole, I get it. That, and you know, I'm glad I asked you that question, but that's a personal thing with me. I can't stand to see that, some of the stuff that goes on in social media. You take it just a negative book review where someone, you know, that they're saying something really bad about a book that's not, they didn't even read the book, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, I get it. And I do not understand that at all.
I've had countless, but one in particular that I'm thinking, so on Twitter, you know, that they'll mention me and bash me. So I would block their account. They create another one. I've had people make honestly, 10 new screen names for the sake of bashing me. It blows my – and that, again, those are the experiences that have gotten me to the point now where it really doesn't bother me.
Well, all right. Let's shift gears and talk about something more positive here.
please. I'm getting depressed over here.
All right. So something else I saw you talk about is the small decisions being the key to success. Can you talk about that? This is really
important. Yeah. I look at what I'm doing now with speaking, and I'm realizing that any opportunities that I have are the result of the way I've lived my life. When I beat Rick's story on June 26, 2011, and literally my life changed, quote, overnight, it didn't change overnight. It was the life I had lived since I was 8 years old. So all of it, it's a compound interest or dividends or the snowball effect, but it really and truly is, my opinion is, focusing on your vision. And it could be a vision for a year from now, could be 2 years, could be 10 or 50 years, causes you to live the life, the daily life that you need to live to get that vision. I can't wake up tomorrow and have a vision of being in the NBA. I've done nothing in my life to make that even a remote possibility.
Yes.
So it's those consistent daily actions that result in what you dream about.
Yeah, that is so important. And it's, again, something we talk about here a lot on the show. And it's – so the mentality today a lot is the quick fix. You know, I want this result really fast tomorrow, by the end of next week. And it really just doesn't happen that way. And I wanted to ask you that because you just explained it. It's the little things that we do on a continuous basis. It's that compound interest effect, the snowball effect. And that is what gives us success over time.
And, you know, so I do a variety of things when I'm working with a guy who was a fan and became a friend who was very overweight. And he had said to me over and over, you know, I want to train. I want to train, Charlie. I want to train. And I said, okay. I didn't go begging. I thought when he's ready, he'll come. And it turns out his wife is pregnant and they're expecting a kid. So he came to me and said, all right, I don't have a choice now. I need to do this. So in the last 4 months, he's lost 49 pounds. So in 4 months, he's lost 50 pounds. And he has said to me, it's that consistency. He records everything. We train. He trains on his own. And he has said to me a few times, you know, man, I wish I was losing more. I did this. I went on a diet once and I lost more weight. And I'm saying, man, look, you can if you want. But this is about creating a lifestyle, creating habits, creating a blueprint that's going to last whenever I'm gone, whenever we stop working together. And it's that same exact thing. It's like, if you want the quick fix, go and get it, but it's not going to last.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, when I opened up, I introduced you as a professional MMA fighter, speaker, author, mentor. Let me ask you about the speaker part. What are you doing as far as your speaking? And you said you're transitioning into the speaking opportunities. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I guess, you know, at this point, it's been over a year, so I guess I can stop saying transitioning. But what I've done is I've essentially taken my journey, right? And my book is entitled Driven, My Unlikely Journey from Classroom to Cage. And it's a story that I've been told over and over and over again is an awesome story. And so what I did was I transitioned or I developed all of my experiences, my journey, starting from when I was a kid, you know, and saw Rocky for the first time. And I put it into a program in both a keynote type program, but also in workshops. I've essentially developed a whole curriculum around my life and my success principles. And I do a lot of speaking. Most of it is to young people, middle, high schools, and universities. I've done several corporate events, which I'm hoping to really grow and expand in that arena also. But it's identified, it aligns with the way I've lived my life. So when And I've realized very quickly I'm not a good salesman. You know, if I try to write sales copy or I try to sell you, Scott, on my program, I'm going to sound like the biggest dummy in the world. So the way I say to people is, look, just go to my website, read my book. If you read what I'm writing, then, you know, I promise I'll deliver an awesome presentation.
Nice. Now, the other part was the mentor that I mentioned. So I'm going to ask you the question I have asked a couple of guests on past episodes. What is the big advice? How do you recommend people find a role model or mentor? Because that can be a challenge for some people. So what would be the step-by-step approach?
Absolutely. It can be extremely challenging because I speak to a lot of people, a lot of young people. Some of them come from great, you know, towns, families, support systems. Some of them come from the opposite. First, the very first thing I would say is if someone says, you know, like, you don't know me, you don't know where I come from, et cetera. There are so many role models and mentors for free online. Get online, get on YouTube, Google whatever it is that you like, whatever it is, music, art, whatever. Google it, get on YouTube and start reading about and listening to people in that particular facet, because there are people for everyone. So first I would say, get online and look, you know, YouTube it, you'll find stuff. Two, books. I read so many books. These people are indirectly my mentors. And then getting from there into the face-to-face, once you start reading, once you start listening, then start reaching out. I believe every kid in our country is entitled to public education. And there are teachers, there are guidance counselors, there are principals. There are good people. You just have to look for them. It's the law of attraction. If you set out with the attitude that there is no one out there for me, I'm a loner, chances are you're not going to find anyone. If you take that opposite approach and go looking, one, I'm going to guarantee you'll find it. Two, if you don't find it, email me and then I double guarantee that you'll find it because I will respond.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of ways to go about this. And I think, again, we've talked about this on the show, but there's this idea of having a virtual mentor. And that can be basically through the books you read, because you're always learning from, you know, the books. Anytime someone writes a book, you wrote a book, I wrote a book, this is our philosophy. This is our message, our values to people. And there's so much to learn from any book you read. So that's one really easy way to find a, quote, virtual mentor. And then the other thing is the live mentor that you were talking about, where you find people online, you can reach out to them. But where do you think that people drop the ball with live mentorship?
Which side? The people seeking or the people?
The people seeking.
Because if I'm a young person – okay, so let's take two people. If I'm a young person looking for a mentor, or I'm a middle-aged man who's unhappy in his professional and personal life, and I'm seeking a mentor, and then I talk to the mentor for the very first time, and the mentor says exactly what I and you have been saying this whole conversation, is there's no secrets, it's consistency over time, small things. The average person doesn't want to hear that. The average person wants a secret. No, Charlie, how can I get to the UFC like in a month or two or 6 months? And it just doesn't work that way. So I think the biggest hindrance or obstacle is that the majority of people are not truly, dedicated, capable of putting in the work that is required to get what you want.
Got it. So I guess they can really follow through with the things that they are advised on. And then another thing I think, and I'm bringing this up, is because I've seen a lack of follow-up. I don't know if you've seen that as well, but I think that people, you know, once they establish communication, you know, feel free to check in and follow up. You know, if I give advice, reach back out and let that mentor know that you did that thing. What's next? What can I do? You know, give them some feedback so they can keep you moving.
The truth of it is we don't really know each other. You know, we're talking for the first time, but if you see traits in me that you have in you, or and then maybe you're 5 years beyond where I'm at professionally and you see me just like you were 5 years ago, chances are you're going to reach out and you're going to help. Not asking for anything, but saying, hey, man, I respect what you're doing. This is what I think. And I believe that's the way the world works. I know for me personally, if I see a young kid putting in the work, I'm going to train them for free. I'm going to do everything I can to offer my services because I see what they're putting into it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. So we're talking about role models and mentors. I'm curious, who have been the top role models or mentors for you? If you had to name maybe the top three, the guys that have had the biggest impact on you as an athlete and as a person, and then how do they impact you?
Well, without a doubt, you know, it started with my parents. My parents are, you know, the biggest impact ever in my life. Beyond them, you know, I've had great coaches, you know, my college coaches, like I had said, Rocky Bonomo, Carl Poff, they helped out extremely. My coaches in professional fighting. But something that I'm really kind of experiencing tenfold while I'm building my speaking career is I've had, I would say, two major, major mentors and one friend/mentor that have helped me tremendously. Keith Eldred, who I self-published my book, but without Keith, it would have taken me another year to learn all the things that he just essentially gave to me out of the goodness of his heart. The first professional speaker that I met, Kevin Sensenig, and these are just normal guys who respected what I was doing, who taught me what it was to speak and how to structure your talks. And then a friend of mine who also is on the same journey I am, Jim Harshaw, who has a much different story, and we complement each other very well. And you know, those three have helped me an extreme amount, you know, in the last year developing my program.
Excellent. Charlie, what do you hope that your story will do for others? And maybe talk about your book here. So again, your book is Driven, My Unlikely Journey from Classroom to Cage. What do you hope that people are going to get out of your book?
You know, a lot of people ask me, you know, what I hope to be thought of or my legacy or, you know, what's my purpose. So I know, I'll put it pretty simply, I know what I think and what I feel when I look at someone like The Rock, you know, The Rock, Rocky right. Maivia. And I want to do that for people. I want to be that symbol of, I don't know if you want to call it hope, inspiration, drive, motivation, but that's exactly what I want to do. I want to live my life fully. So someone looks at me like I look at The Rock and I make them feel how The Rock makes me feel. And in terms of my book, it was just, I'm a small town guy who comes from a middle-class family who had a dream of becoming a professional fighter, and I didn't sit on the dream. I acted, I lived it, and I accomplished it. And it's still sometimes when I'm sitting, you know, my sister got married this weekend, so we're all sitting around watching TV and there were fights on TV, and I'm sitting there thinking, man, those guys are crazy. And then I thought, holy cow, I am one of those guys. And it really, I don't know, man, it's just a very neat thing to have set out on a goal, done it.
Right.
And I really, really and truly, I want to help other people do it. There's no ulterior motive. I'm driven to do that.
What's the accomplishment that you're most proud of? Is there one thing that you're most proud of at this point?
You know what? I think it's writing my book.
Really?
Because, wow. Yeah, I was born an athlete. You know, I was kind of born a fighter. You know, I learned, but I mean, I had the groundwork from wrestling. And, you know, I had always gotten good grades. But if you would have told me 10 years ago, Charlie, you'll either be a UFC fighter or you'll be an author, I would have said I'll be a UFC fighter, because I never would have dreamed that I would have written a book. So, you know, that means a lot to me.
That's an incredible accomplishment. It's something I discovered myself in the past several months, how hard it was. And I've talked about this. This is a project that I started a couple of years ago, and 6 months before the book came out is when I really buckled down and got things done. And it was a lot of hours, a lot of hard work, a lot of late nights, and the accomplishment is incredible. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and I was the same way. I had gotten most of it written. I was at a standstill. I was paralyzed. I was nervous. I was anxious. I thought, what if people hate it? What if? And then, yeah, I mean, 6 months for me, it was about 2.5 months because it was already done, that me and Keith sat down and I said, all right, I want to do this. You offered your help. Are you serious about helping me? Let's go. And then we got it done.
Well, what I like about your book so far, and again, I'm early on into it, but a lot of stories there. So you relate the stories to the lessons, to the themes in the book. And it's been really great so far. So I'm really looking forward to finishing it up. And congratulations, of course. I did want to ask you, what would be your big recommendation or advice for anyone that's listening that is interested in fighting themselves? We have a pretty diverse audience here, some fighters, some coaches. So what advice do you have for those that are actually in the fight game or looking to get involved in the fight game?
So I'm actually probably going to write a blog about this today or tomorrow. But when I got into the sport, I had done pretty well in wrestling, so I was able to differentiate, the schemers from the real credible guys. And I met a guy by the name of Eddie Alvarez, who is still one of the top fighters in the world. He's in the UFC now. And so two things I would pass on. One, he said to me very early on, he said, look, if you don't go around promoting yourself, no one else will. So I would advise with a very humble attitude. I certainly don't recommend being an arrogant jerk, but don't forget that if no one knows about you, then you can't conquer the world. You can't get anywhere if people don't know how good you are. So you need to focus on promoting yourself or putting the right people around you to promote yourself. And two, surrounding yourself with, I won't necessarily say, the best manager in the game, but I would certainly say with the best team. You know, there are a lot of shysters out there in MMA who say this and do that. You know, do your homework, check up on them, find out if they're legit, if they're not legit. And I openly put this out there. I'd be more than happy. Someone tells you something, send me an email and I'll let you know if they're legit or not, because it's a small world and it's easy to tell if someone is being honest or not. Everything we do is online. So if someone tells you they won X tournament four times and it's not online, chances are they didn't win it. So, right, do your homework in that regard as well.
Absolutely. Question I always ask my guests here is, what's the one book you'd recommend or that you do recommend the most to others and why?
There's so many books. And when I was running, I listened to a podcast. I listened to Tim Ferriss' podcast with this author. So and it's one of my favorite books, but The Alchemist. Paulo Coelho wrote it. He's a Brazilian guy. It's just a tremendous book. I generally don't read fiction, but I was Bass Rutten, who's actually another fighter, recommended it. And so I read it. And it's just tremendous.
Yeah. Classic.
Talking about journeys. There it is.
All right, your website is charlie-brenneman.com. We'll have links for the website, everything that we talked about in the show notes. Your book is available on amazon.com. Is there anywhere else that people should go to check you out, to connect online?
Anything? Absolutely. If anyone's interested in working with me in terms of speaking or mentoring, I'm looking for a handful. And when I say a handful, I mean 10 high school athletes that I'm looking to mentor virtually. And, if you are one of them or you know one of them, please direct them to my website. Charlie-Brenneman.com houses everything I do, my speaking program, my mentoring program, and my background. I encourage you, check up on me. Make sure I'm legit, because absolutely, if I don't fit your bill, then maybe I'm not the best one for you. But, I can promise that it's all there, and I appreciate every ounce of support that I get.
Where should people go to check out the mentoring, Charlie, that you just mentioned? Is there a specific tab on there?
Yes, I was going to say. So if you go to charlie-brenneman.com/COE for Culture of Excellence, it will bring you to the page. Or if you go into the Work With Me section, you will find it as well.
Okay. We'll make sure that we put a link for that in the show notes as well. All right. The final question for you is, what's the one thing that you'd like every listener from the audience to take away from our interview today? Something they can hopefully take action with and apply in their life.
So when I was a kid, when I was very young, my parents essentially took my siblings and I aside at one point or another and said, if you dedicate yourself to academics and athletics, we will take care of the rest. And what that did for me at a young age was it established a standard of excellence in everything that I do. And I'm not saying that I'm perfect. I'm not saying I've maintained that standard in everything I've done, but it's definitely at the forefront of my mind. And I would challenge everyone out there to operate on a standard of excellence. Call yourself on it. Live an accountable life.
I love it. And what you're saying there with the academics and athletics, that's really the mind and body training. And I don't really care how old you are, we can continue to develop ourselves, like we talked about earlier, indefinitely. It's really up to us to have that accountability and a standard of excellence to continue to keep moving forward. So I love that, Charlie.
Absolutely. And just like Eddie said, you know, if I don't go around promoting myself, we'll change that to if you don't go around challenging yourself, if you don't go around challenging and living accountably, no one else is going to.
Yes. Excellent. Charlie, thank you so much, man. This has been a really great chat. I know that people are going to get a lot of value out of this one. And thank you for being here.
My pleasure. I had a blast.
Guys, thank you so much for joining us this week. Be sure to take action with the information and apply something you learned from the show. We'll see you next time on the Ardella Training Podcast. Take care. Hey guys, thanks for listening to the podcast this week. And if you'd like to become part of the Ardella Training community, be sure to go to ardellatraining.com/join to get your free training mistakes guide, which contains 12 critical training mistakes I made through the years. I know this 36-page guide will save you time and frustration and accelerate your training results. And it's free. You'll get that and so much more at ardellatraining.com/join. Hope to see you there.